Welcome to a new episode of Awami Podcast. This is the second episode of season 3. We are recording it right now and it will be released soon. This episode is really important and special for me because it's my first English recorded episode. It's a really unique experience for me to start recording in English with international guests. I want to welcome Carl with me. Hello, Carl.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Oh, no, thank you for being here with us in Awami Podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, thanks. And yourself?
Okay, perfect. So we were trying to record this episode for a while now. I really want to thank Carl for being here.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Okay, perfect. So let's start with knowing more about you. I want you to introduce yourself for the listeners. Like, who is Carl Swanepoel? Do I pronounce it right?
Yeah, you are pronouncing it right, and I'm sure. I'm Carl. I run a company called Ravalonta, which I founded just under 2 years ago during my last year at university. And basically what the company's goal is to make the world fairer for freelancers. So we connect freelancers with small businesses, but we put freelancers first, and ultimately that way we build the best talent base. But like I said, I've been running that business for about 2 years since founding it. Took it all the way from an idea stage in my university dorm room to then raising a first bit of capital through a grant and a startup competition at my university as well. 6 months later, we raised venture capital funding from a top VC in London for our pre-seed round. We then expanded the team. And now a year later, we are raising our seed round with our platform now having about 15,000 users.
Well, perfect. So I really want to ask about something. I go to your Ravalonta website and go to the about the webpage. So I see that you are calling yourself a next generation freelancing platform. What makes you a next generation and how could you get profit as long as you get zero commission fees from freelancers?
Yeah, sure. So basically, current freelancing platforms, and this has been the reality for the past 20 years or so, but current freelancing platforms have followed the model where the way they make money is they take a commission fee from freelancers' work. So for example, you know, I could hire you on a platform like, say, Fiverr, for example. I pay you $1,000 and then you only get $800 at the end because Fiverr takes a 20% commission fee. And that's how current platforms operate. So what we do differently is we don't charge any commission fees whatsoever. So, you know, if I hired you on Ravalonta and I pay you $1,000, you receive $1,000. And instead of that, the way we make money is through a subscription plan. So basically, for you as the freelancer to access additional features, such as being able to bid on more client requests, get insights into how other freelancers are bidding and a couple of other features, you can upgrade to Ravalonta Plus, which is a paid plan. But still, it will be, you know, a lot more affordable than paying large commission fees, because on traditional marketplaces where you pay, say, 20% commission, you know, you can imagine, let's say you make $50,000 in a year on a platform like that, you'll pay them $10,000 just in fees. And it also means that you can't speak with your clients outside of the platform. So we allow people to speak with their clients outside of the platform. We don't charge any commission fees. And that's why I believe that we are a next generation freelancing platform.
Perfect. But let me ask you that. As I'm freelancing myself for a while, I can get some clients in a month and none in the second month. You know that freelancing are up and down. You don't always get clients and you don't always work. So with freelancing subscriptions, do I need to like subscribe?
No, you don't. So there's also a free tier that's still more than good enough to kind of get your first couple of clients before you start paying.
Okay, perfect. Most of my audience are from students because I was a student and I'm now a fresh grad myself. And a lot of them are interested in how did you like manage your time in university? Like, you know that you told me that you got the idea in the dorms and you worked with the team from your university. So how did you manage your time between Ravalonta as a project idea or a platform idea that you are working on as your baby, you want to grow up, and as yourself as Carl?
Yeah, sure. Basically, I've always wanted to start a business. So that was always my priority over paying much attention in school and then later in university as well. So that, you know, that was always front and center for me. So I've been trying various different online businesses and projects and so on since I was about 13 years old. And when I got to halfway through my final year of university, you know, we were in a COVID lockdown at the time. So there was a big kind of shift in remote work and a bigger demand of, you know, for remote work. And I had been familiar with the freelancing industry for quite a while because I started freelancing myself. I also in the past built and sold a small freelancing platform when I was a teenager. So I was quite familiar with the market. I saw that the large platforms weren't adapting to a post-pandemic world of remote work. So then I knew that, you know, I wanted to do something about that and to actually make this industry fairer. So, I saw that my university hosted a startup competition where you could pitch your business and then win a couple of grants if you were fortunate enough to do so. I entered that. I spent more time and attention on preparing for that pitch than I did for any piece of university work at the time. Needless to say, I think I was probably the most prepared going into that. And then I was also fortunate enough to win both of the main grants. So that was some initial seed money that we used to get the process started, to build the initial small team of co-founders, and then also to build a minimum viable product or MVP version of the platform. And then using that, getting 100 users on or so, we then approached external investors to try and take the platform to the next level. And then we raised a pre-seed round shortly after I graduated. I think it was about 2 or 3 months after I graduated that we closed our pre-seed round. And we've just been growing it ever since. So I suppose my my kind of university startup journey was a lot of focusing more on the business than on university work.
So what was the most challenging part of all of that? You told me that it was getting the idea itself and the seed and like working on it. What was the most challenging part of all that made you think that, oh no, I won't be able to do it?
I tend not to think in that way. You know, that's not to say that I think I know everything. I'm very much aware that I know very little in the grand scheme of things. But the way I tend to think about things I don't know yet is exactly like that. It's just something that I don't know yet, but something that I can learn. So I can't really point at one thing to say, like, that's the biggest challenge. But, you know, as kind of starting this business, you know, at quite a young age, I had a lot of firsts. You know, it was my first time raising investment. It was certainly my first time raising institutional investment from a venture capital firm. It was my first time employing people, handling a bunch of these legals. You know, there were a lot of firsts for me there. But what I always do is I try and surround myself with people who have done it before. So I'm, you know, I have a lot of really good mentors, advisors, people who I speak to who have done these things in the past, who I can then learn from, you know, and then I can go from not knowing how to do something at all to then just taking it one step at a time and learning. So, you know, 2 years ago, I didn't know the first thing about employing people, how payroll works, you know, how to interview people effectively, how to approach investors, how to raise funding, how to manage all the legals around that and so on. But now I have a pretty good understanding of all of those topics just by, you know, going out there and learning and trying them. So that's, I think that's kind of the, well, I mean, for me anyway, that's the mindset that has worked the best is, you know, not kind of getting intimidated by what I don't know, but just acknowledging that I don't know it yet, but it's something that I can learn and then taking action to learn that.
So talking about how to legalize and this kind of thing, a lot of problems here in Arab world and the Middle East that they can't really go into freelancing because of something like, how can I get my money? And a lot of freelancing platforms doesn't actually offer more and more options to receive money from overseas. I guess Revolancer is based on UK, right?
It's an international platform. We have freelancers from all around the world. And I suppose what makes us different here is we allow you to build clients off platform. So if there is some kind of payment service that is supported in your country, then you can use that. You can use that to build clients. We don't insist that you go through our platform. You can go through our platform and we use PayPal. And you're more than welcome to use that if you want to. But if you don't like using PayPal or your country doesn't support it, then you can use whatever does work in your country as long as the client is also happy to use that.
Okay. So as I was saying that many freelancers here have some problems in setting up an account and receiving money. You already covered the receiving money point, but how can you ensure that this person is a real person? Do you require any kind of legal paper or ID confirmation from the freelancer and the client?
Sure. So we don't currently, do many checks like that, in that regard of kind of looking at legal papers and so on. But what we do is, look at a number of other holistic features about the person, slightly different for clients, slightly different for freelancers. So, with businesses, we want to kind of see that it's a registered business. Also, once a freelancer or business has interacted with the platform for a little while, they'll have received reviews, and those reviews show on their public profile. And also if someone receives kind of, reports or negative reviews quite a lot, then that's something that we look into. But we also offer the ability for people to pay through the platform at any point. And in this case, the client will pay up front. We will then hold the money until the freelancer delivers the service. And then if both parties are happy, then the freelancer will get paid. And this basically stops the client from, not paying. And it also stops the freelancer from just leaving with the money and not delivering the work that they were being paid for. So we have that option available. We do absolutely recommend that for, the initial transaction if you haven't worked with a certain client yet or if you haven't worked with a certain freelancer yet. But then after that, it's completely up to you whether you want to stay on or off platform. So we advise people to, use common sense to be careful. And then also based on the data we collect, we can make decisions. If there's somebody on the platform who's causing issues, we can remove them swiftly so that they don't cause problems for anyone else.
Getting back to you and leaving Revolancer for a second, we will definitely get back to it. But giving back to you, you were a freelancer yourself before setting up Revolancer and starting your business, right?
Yes, that's correct. I was.
What was the most annoying things that you saw in like other freelancing platforms that made you think that I want to change the industry and I want to start a new generation for a freelancing platform? What was the most like annoying and that really get your nerve?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's a couple of things. With the platforms I was on at the time, it was very hard to get started on those platforms without like a kind of a track record of reviews already and kind of get my first clients. I was able to do that, but it was very difficult. And I think that those platforms heavily advantage freelancers who already have had a lot of work through those platforms. But when I kind of got started with that, to a large part, it was, one, the commission fees, but also then the fact that because of the commission fees, I couldn't speak with my clients outside of the platform. So I couldn't continue really developing a relationship with that client because I couldn't call with them. I couldn't get their email address. I couldn't speak with them outside of the platform. And the reason why that is, like I mentioned before, is because of the commission fees, because otherwise, I could pay outside of ask the client to pay outside of the platform, pay me directly, and then the freelancing platform doesn't get their commission fee. So I'd say those are the main kind of pain points, and all of them we address with Revolancer, to try and make that better.
Okay, so as a freelancer, what was like the most funny situations that happened with you and a client? I really want to hear. I love my stories, so I really want to hear what you have on mind.
Sure. Funny story. I mean, I can tell you a bunch of horror stories. I don't know about how many funny stories I have from then. But yeah, I mean, I suppose.
Get comfortable. I would love to hear it.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one particular story that I remember is I designed a website for a company that was local to me, and it kind of the project budget in the first place was very low. So we're talking a few hundred dollars, you know. So easily, if they went to an agency, the agency would have easily charged them 10 times what I did to deliver what they were asking for. But I was willing to take, you know, a much lower rate because I was, you know, I was like kind of starting out. I think at the time I was around 17 or 18. So I just wanted to get started. And you know, and kind of it went from they wanted to have a website with, I think it was something like 10 pages, to then suddenly wanting a website with like 200 pages. And you know, that's not an exaggeration, because essentially what they wanted me to do is to create sort of individual pages for all these different products that they had. This was for a shop. And at first I paid somebody else, you know, pretty much half of the project budget, if not more, to build the majority of the website. They didn't like that. I then went ahead and built the whole thing again from scratch. They didn't like that. You know, they wanted changes constantly. They wanted me to add all this other stuff to it. And I think based on how many hours I worked on that project, I would have probably been paid like a couple of dollars per hour, like well below minimum wage. And then in the end, you know, after I jumped through all these hoops for them, you know, at a huge loss to myself, they then said, oh, this project isn't working out. We want a full refund. And, you know, and I was quite scared of this because, you know, it was this kind of, you know, what I thought at the time was a big company, you know, now saying that they want a refund, you know, kind of sending a threatening email. And I very nearly gave them a refund. But then I kind of took a step back and thought that they were being so unreasonable, because I mean, I went really above and beyond, you know, in the very first instance, I delivered them a website. They weren't happy with it. I then designed it again from scratch. I shouldn't have even done that. I wish that I could go back in time and you know, not waste my time doing that. But I think it's an important story, because I'm sure that, you know, if any freelancers are listening to this, that people can certainly relate to this. I hope that it didn't get this far with anyone else, but it very well may have. I mean, this isn't too uncommon. But the important lesson out of that is to value your work, value yourself properly, and don't be afraid to stand up to a client if they're being unreasonable. And these people were certainly being unreasonable. But I didn't end up giving them a refund, and I ended up keeping my, you know, $1 or $2 per hour kind of payment for all the hard work I did for them. So yeah, I'd say I think looking back now, it's quite a funny story. At the time, it was definitely a horror story. But it was a very important learning experience for me, and hopefully it can help someone else as well.
That's definitely an important story more than a funny one, because I had a similar experience, and I know a lot of people that had similar experiences. But there was a question that related to your story. It's about, here in Egypt or many countries, the minimum wage and the pricing are different from one place for another. So, for example, a lot of people here work for way less than the same work as if happened in UK or US or whatever, get the same pricing. So a lot of people here settle for way less, and a lot of people doesn't know how can I get a fair pricing strategy to evaluate my work and tell you that my work costs, for example, $5 for an hour. A lot of people think that, oh, that's way too much because you are from not from US, so you how will you spend that money? So what do you think about getting your pricing? How do you convince people that your pricing is fair, and how do you set it up at the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good and very important question. And I think that the answer in my view is that pricing shouldn't be determined by your location or, you know, even what you think you should be charging, what you think your time is worth. No, what you should look at is what is the value that you're providing to the client. So, you know, if a client is paying you to build them a website, there's a good chance that that website is going to help them generate a lot of business. So, you know, if they're a company that currently doesn't have a website and they're making, I don't know, $100,000 a year, let's say for argument's sake, and now they're going to go onto the internet and suddenly their demand is going to double because now people aren't just finding them, you know, in the phone book or you know, in the newspaper or wherever, but now people are finding them online as well. Now suddenly they make $200,000. You have essentially created, you know, $100,000 worth of business for them. And that's worth more than $5 an hour. You know, I think then you can easily justify charging a few thousand dollars for the website. So I think it depends not on you so much, but it depends on the client and the value of the service that you are offering them. So that's how you have to think about it. You know, and I think that's also how clients should think about it. And good clients do think about it that way. I think, you know, you have some bad clients who will purposefully try and find cheap labor. But, you know, oftentimes you get what you pay for because it doesn't matter where you live in the world. You know, the best people still charge what their service is worth to the company. And then if, you know, so you ultimately you get what you pay for. But that's how I would absolutely suggest thinking about it. So not in terms of what you think your time is worth or what sort of the average wages in your country or basing it on that, but really thinking about what value are you bringing to the business and then trying to work backwards from there. So like, let's say you want to build them a website, you might normally charge $300, but you know, let's say my example is true. They, you know, they don't currently have an online presence. They currently make $100,000. With the website, they're probably going to make $200,000, you know, in the next coming few years. I think at that point, it's fair to say you will, you know, charge them 1-2% of that. So you charge them at least a couple thousand dollars, you know, even if you normally charge $300. And you know, they should in that case be happy to pay that too, because they can see the potential of what it is you're building for them, and they still get to, you know, keep the majority of it. So yeah, I hope that's useful, and that's my view on pricing.
Perfect. So a lot of my friends are actually freelancers, and you need to shift from one mindset, that the freelancing mindset. All you think about is your work, how you like improve it and stuff like that. And then suddenly you get a business idea and you are an entrepreneur now and you want to start your business. So you need a whole different mindset. Thinking about your payrolls, how to set up a business, how to market your business. And either you do that in the house, like gather some of your connections and pay the money to make the marketing and make the maybe the visual identity and stuff like that. Or you go to professional companies to set you up that work and start things for you. So from your experience, what worked the best for you between these two options?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I think it depends what you're trying to achieve. You know, if you're happy just sort of freelancing as a one person thing, then that's great and that's what you should do. But if you would like to kind of expand the operation, what I think is best, the best way to kind of build a team and a business around you is to focus on what you are good at and do that, and then outsource the rest. You know, so if you're really good at getting new customers, but you're not so good at, you know, building the product, then you focus on getting new customers and then you hire someone else to build the product for them. Or if it's, you know, if it's the opposite, let's say you're a really good web developer, but you're not very good at sales or talking to other people, and that's just not what you're interested in, then hire someone else, hire a salesperson to do that so you can focus on doing what you're good at. Because they probably can't build a website, but they're very good at persuading people to buy a website, you know? So that makes a very good team then. So I'd say that's the best way. It's if possible, try not to do everything yourself, unless, again, that is what you want to do and you want to work as, you know, by yourself. There's a huge appeal in that and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But if you do want to expand the operation, the best way to do it is to focus on what you're really good at and then find other people who are really good at the things that you don't want to do or you're not that good at, because that way you build the best team and you've got the best chance of making it big.
So let me ask you that. I guess you said that before in a podcast episode that if you are an employee and work from 9 to 5, when you own a business, you are working 24 hours, working in a company, all you need to worry about is getting your job done and that's it. How do you balance between your personal life and your work after owning a business? I know that a lot of people stuck in their business and even the free time of their use it in attending events and listening to customer feedbacks and doing something that related to their businesses as well, even if it's a little lighter than the work itself. But how do you balance your work and your hobbies and your personal life? How do you get free time and don't think that you need to work in your free time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good and very important question. And the honest answer is that it's not always that easy to do, you know. With that saying, you know, you don't want to work 9 to 5, but now you work 24/7. That doesn't even have to be, you know, you are at your computer 24/7, because I mean, that wouldn't last very long. But, you know, but what it means is you're sort of working in your head, because the difference is if you work from 9 to 5, yes, you have to fulfill your responsibilities while you are there. But then for the most part, outside of that, you can just switch off and you can think about other stuff. But if you're running a business, and even if you're a freelancer as well, you know, you're sort of thinking about the business in some way or another, even subconsciously in the back of your head, you're thinking about the business 24/7. And that can get very draining. And what I find, and I have learned this the hard way, but you need to have a sufficient work-life balance. You need to get good rest. You need to live a healthy lifestyle in order to perform at your best overall. And that means that even if you work fewer hours than you would otherwise, so instead of, let's say, 12 hours, you work 10 hours or 9 hours or 8 hours, you might get a lot more done if you are sleeping longer, you know, and if you are taking breaks and you know, taking some time to rest, to exercise, to focus on things outside of the business. You'll be more productive in the time that you are working. And that's something that I had to learn the hard way, because I used to think that, you know, just simply the more hours worked, the better. And that's just simply not true. It's not about the number of hours worked. It's about the quality of that time. And nobody has just an unlimited supply of energy, you know, and creativity. So you need to recharge your battery so that you can work effectively in the time that you are working. So I think what's important is to realize that and to really understand it, and then to focus on, you know, on yourself as well. And if you really feel like you can't do that, then there is probably too much on your plate. And that means that you either need to maybe scale back what you do, maybe work with slightly fewer clients if you're a freelancer, you know, or if you run a business or you're a freelancer, is maybe hire someone to help you out, like hire an assistant or hire somebody just to, you know, help you. Like, let's say one of your tasks is, you know, I don't know, checking customer feedback, for example. Hire someone else to do that. Get them to, you know, you train them, you tell them what to do, but then they can compile reports for you. You can hire a freelancer to do that, even if it's like 1 hour a day or, you know, 1 hour a week or whatever it is, whatever makes sense. That frees up time for you that you can then either work on something else or sort of spend time recharging so you work more effectively in general. So I'd say understand the importance of a good work-life balance. And then if you still feel you can't have a good work-life balance, either scale back what you do or get some help, you know, get someone else to support you with what you're doing so that you can continue doing it, but also have kind of a healthy lifestyle alongside that.
Exactly. And let me add that if you don't have a healthy lifestyle, at the end, that you will drop out your business idea and you will drop out everything and you will just leave everything behind you because you pushed yourself too hard. So you can't do anything any longer, and you will get into the critical moments of your life, the critical moments that determine your business, how it will be, and you will do very shitty work in these moments. So everything will just collapse on you. So from prior experience, this is very important because you need to be ready and you need to be rest in important moments, and you don't need to overwhelm yourself with everything. You need to prioritize how do you handle your work. So I totally agree with you. And the second thing that I think that affect negatively on your project is comparing yourself to others. So I want to hear your say on that. How do you prevent yourself from comparing your platform or yourself to other people? Like maybe you found a platform that started after you and it got a big hit and it's really successful now, and you maybe got a lot of work more than them in your opinion, and you just say that it's not fair, why do they have to success and I am not? Even in on personal scale or on the business scale on Revolancer. And the second thing that I think that affect negatively on your project is comparing yourself to others. So I want to hear your say on that. How do you prevent yourself from comparing your platform or yourself to other people? Like maybe you found a platform that started after you and it got a big hit and it's really successful now, and you maybe got a lot of work more than them in your opinion, and you just say that it's not fair, why do they have to success and I am not? Even in on personal scale or on the business scale on Revolancer, how do you accept that and let yourself don't compare to each other?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important question. And it is absolutely important that you don't compare yourself to other people, or, you know, you compare your business to other businesses in that regard. It's, you know, because I think ultimately what's important to realize is that it is just not a useful exercise. I mean, in what possible way does it help you to kind of sit there and compare yourself to other people? It really doesn't, especially if that that comparison is just going to make you kind of upset, and kind of sad about where you are, and you think that someone else has kind of come further, and you never know the whole story. People start at different points in life. Some people work harder than others. There is always an element of luck involved. You know, it might be that you try your first business and it absolutely blows up and you're massively successful, but it's purely luck. You were at the right place, you know, at the right time, you knew the right people. There are all these different factors that play into it. So it's really, you know, even if you wanted to, it's impossible to accurately compare yourself to someone else, because even if they've achieved something at a younger age, or they've achieved something in, you know, like less time than you have, you don't know the full story. So what, you know, that's unproductive. But what is productive is to focus on yourself and compare yourself to, you know, yourself in the past. That's the only person you should ever compare yourself to. You should compare yourself to the person you were yesterday, last month, last year, 10 years ago, you know, whatever it is. And you know, and then you should feel like you have made some progress against, you know, like in terms of your own journey. But it's just a completely unproductive exercise to compare yourself to others. And I didn't think it can do any good. So yeah, it's a very important point. And it's just really, really not worth doing. You know, focus, understand what your goals are, what your motivations are, and just focus on getting there. And, you know, just look forward. Don't look sideways, if that makes sense.
It makes perfectly sense. So let me ask you that. What advice would you have for aspiring entrepreneurs that who are just starting out? If you have one advice for them, the most important thing that you need to tell them, and you wish that someone told you that when you were starting your business, what was it?
So I would say, don't be afraid to fail. You know, I think failing can sound scary. It can sound embarrassing. It can sound expensive. It can sound depressing. It can, you know, there are all number of, you know, negative things associated with failure. But good entrepreneurs, like the best and most successful entrepreneurs, do not think that way. A failure, you know, yeah, it sucks, you know, try and avoid it, sure, but embrace it if you do fail, because it's a learning experience, you know. I have failed in 95%, you know, plus of things that I have ever tried. But that doesn't bother me. In fact, I'm very happy about that, because let's say if the first thing I ever tried made me super successful, then I would have never really learned, you know, it would have just been luck. But I really feel like I'm learning. You know, I can now understand why something failed, and now moving forward, I can make, you know, I can not make the same mistakes again. I can avoid those pitfalls. I've really learned from what I've done, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. If anything, I wish I failed even more, because then I would have learned even more. So I'd say, you know, you need to work on your relationship with the idea of failing, and get to a point where you are comfortable just embracing it, you know, and not being afraid of it, and seeing it as the learning experience that it truly is. And that way, if you're not afraid of failure, you know, you just go out there, you try, you try to achieve your goals, you'll fail time and time again. But if you stick at it for long enough and you have that kind of mindset, eventually you will be successful. So that's the one piece of advice that I think is most important for me to share today.
Okay, one more thing that I want you to share is your long-term goals for your business. How do you plan, how do you see the future for RevoLancer, and how do you plan to achieve these goals for RevoLancer?
Sure. So my primary goal is to completely flip the freelance industry around, because right now clients are being prioritized at the expense of freelancers. And what that means is that clients are not really getting good freelance work, because, you know, let's say if a marketplace charges a 20% commission, you know, you're paying someone $5,000 to deliver a project, they're receiving $4,000. You cannot realistically expect in that case for them to deliver $5,000 of worth of value, because that's not what they're receiving, you know? So that sucks for the freelancer. It sucks for the client. If you want to get on a phone call to explain something to them and to talk through something, you can't do that, you know, or a video call, you cannot do that on these existing marketplaces. So right now the industry is just set up, you know, in a way that doesn't work for freelancers and doesn't work for clients as well. So what I'm looking to do is to completely change the industry so that freelancers are prioritized, and that way we create the best talent pool. And so it also makes the best situation for clients. So that's my goal with RevoLancer. It's to influence the whole market to change for the better, and to set the new standard. Yeah. So in terms of, you know, where that is with Revalancer, that would either end in Revalancer being kind of a leader in the market. It could end with another, with other platforms changing. It could end with another platform acquiring Revalancer and then, you know, kind of creating a fairer offering for freelancers. Exactly what that end goal looks like in detail, I don't know. You know, it could go any number of different ways. But ultimately, that's my grand vision with Revalancer.
So there will be two last questions. One about what you have just said, acquiring a business and having like an exit point for you from the your business. When do you think that you someone have a need to accept that exit point, and when do you think that someone should keep hanging to their business idea and thinks that it can be get bigger, it can get more successful, and I won't sell, I won't let someone acquire me. So what do you think about that?
Sure. I mean, I think first of all, it's it really depends on the individual circumstance. But, you know, I can give you a scenario where maybe, you know, doing an acquisition is the right choice. So let's say, for example, your business gets bigger and bigger, gaining more traction, more attention in the industry that you're in. And then one of your large competitors approaches you and they, you know, they don't say it exactly like this, but they pretty much say to you that either we buy you or we will compete with you, you know, in a way that will drive you out of the market because, you know, we're big, we've got the resources to undercut you, you know, do whatever. So basically copy you. In that case, it might be the better decision to sell. But it might also not be, because that's actually exactly the situation that happened when Facebook tried to acquire Snapchat. Mark Zuckerberg met with Evan Spiegel, who's the founder of Snapchat, a few years ago. I can't remember when exactly. But basically, he said to him, either we buy your company Snapchat for, I think it was either $2 or $4 billion was their offer. I think $4 billion. But regardless, you know, and then Mark Zuckerberg basically said to Evan Spiegel that if he didn't accept that, Facebook would launch an app called Hope, which was essentially a copy of Snapchat, and they would, you know, send that to their billion users. So immediately they would have a larger user base than Snapchat. And in that case, you know, you might think that, okay, then in that case, you know, selling the company is what you kind of have to do, or, you know, or it'll die. But Evan Spiegel decided not to. He did not sell his company to Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook then launched Poke. They sent a push notification to every single person in the world who had the Facebook app installed, which, you know, was, I think, like a billion people potentially. But anyway, many more people than were using Snapchat. But the app never picked off, and you've probably never even heard of it, you know, of an app called Poke by Facebook. That's a Snapchat competitor. So there, in that case, they absolutely made the right decision to not sell, and Facebook's attempt to, you know, drive them out of the market was just kind of awful, and it didn't go anywhere. So, you know, it's never a simple answer. I think you really need to think about it, but you also need to think, I think the best place to start is to think about what is it that you want? You know, are you building this business to become a market leader? Are you building this business with the eventual goal of kind of selling it and then making some money? I think it's a very individual circumstance-based thing. But, you know, with whatever decision is made, I think the most important thing is to really think it through and to think through different scenarios that could happen if you do or don't go ahead with that. So yeah, that would be my best advice.
Yeah, and I think that Facebook already tried to copy Snapchat in other ways by adding stories in their apps. Instagram has stories, Facebook has stories, WhatsApp has stories, and I guess that the first The first place I saw the concept of stories was in Snapchat at the beginning. So, but people still using Snapchat for other purposes more than stories. And adding stories to Facebook didn't really hurt Snapchat that bad. So I guess you're right in that. It doesn't always mean that when big companies threaten you that we will copy you and we will add new features to our platform so no one will use you. It doesn't always work like that, and not people always use a platform to have certain features. It can be like I am comfortable more with your platform than others, and maybe you can add me more features, like Snapchat adds more security and more privacy features for your messages and your snaps that you send to people more than Messenger, for example. And so people still using Snapchat for similar reasons. So I guess you are right, and I totally agree with you. Let's talk about the new trend that a lot of people said that it will change how industry work, and not just the freelancing industry, it's all the tech industry, which is AI and services like ChatGPT. A lot of people are freaking out that it will end up their careers and it will replace a lot of careers in the future with AI, and a lot of people are actually career shifting to other careers, and a lot of people are trying to learn AI now because from their point of view, that is the safest option now to work in the AI industry and leave all the industries, because all of them will be replaced by AI anyway. So how do you think of ChatGPT and other similar services that are appearing recent days in the industry? And I don't think it's a new thing, because the AI is here for a while now, but it didn't show up in that way before. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a bunch of thoughts on this topic. I'll start with a funny story. So I was playing around with ChatGPT quite a lot over the last, you know, month or so. And one of the things I asked it to do was to prove that 0.9 recurring is equal to 1. And then it gave me a whole big write-up. It gave me a step-by-step proof. But one of the steps in the proof was that, therefore 8/9 is equal to 1, you know, and therefore 0.9 recurring is equal to 1, which is, of course, you know, absolute nonsense. I think that links pretty well into my first kind of point, which is that I don't think that AI is going to replace all jobs, because I think you still, to a degree, need humans in that sort of consultative or quality control kind of standpoint. So, like, let's say, for example, take that example over to an accountancy firm. You know, AI might very well replace some of the lower level jobs, you know, kind of putting the basic accounts together, but you'll still want someone senior, you know, a human, to look over those accounts, make sure they're okay, correct any silly mistakes that have been made, and then sign off on them and submit them, that sort of thing. So I think that AI is a threat to a lot of jobs. I think that we are already starting to see issues. I think that those issues are going to get worse and worse with more and more people, basically not being able to do work that cannot be automated more efficiently for cheaper than hiring them. And I think that's going to be a big, big, big problem. But I don't think that, you know, I think that if you focus on developing a skill and sort of becoming an expert in a field, then those kind of things will often be harder to automate, especially if you can kind of sit in that, you know, quality control or like consultative standpoint where you use AI to help you out. I mean, another example is, let's say you, you know, you write articles. You know, you can get ChatGPT to write the articles for you, but a human still needs to check them over, still needs to edit them, you know, check if there's any nonsense in there. And if you can, you know, be that kind of role, then I think you'll be more kind of safe against this kind of thing taking over. But, you know, if I think about it from a business standpoint right now, we publish articles. Yes, we could probably get ChatGPT to write them, but I wouldn't want to. Yes, you know, it would be cheaper than paying, because right now we pay freelancers from the platform, copywriters, to write magazine articles for us. And I wouldn't want to change that. ChatGPT could probably generate some text. It would probably be, obviously it would be free, so it would be cheaper. Maybe the article would be, you know, quite good. I don't know. But ultimately, I think that's the issue. There's, you know, we're going to need to check that article. We're going to need to make sure that it's, you know, search engine friendly. We're going to need to make sure that that article is accessible, that it makes sense. And then if you add all these extra kind of points in, it makes more sense to just outsource it to a professional, you know, who does their own quality control. And, you know, you can speak with them and they've been doing it for the past X years and have a big track record. So from a, you know, even though we could maybe, you know, probably save some money by doing it that way, I wouldn't want to, from a completely practical standpoint. Of course, we also want to support freelancers. But even if I completely ignore that, we would still be hiring freelancers to do it instead of getting something like ChatGPT to do it. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to underplay the issue, because I think certainly that AI does pose a threat to many jobs. And I think that that's, you know, we're going to see the effects of that more and more and more over the coming years. But equally, I think for now, there isn't, you know, there's no sense in worrying. But there's, you know, there is some sense in specializing in a certain field, or, you know, and kind of figuring out what is likely to be automated, what is less likely to be automated, you know, sort of harder to automate, and then kind of adjusting your career path or education path or, you know, whatever it is, appropriately. I think that's the best thing that you can do.
Exactly. And let me add something. I saw a post on LinkedIn that saying that people worrying about AI really lookalikes people worrying about machines in the Industrial Revolution. And when machines first invented, a lot of people said that we will lose our jobs, no one will work anymore, all people will stay in homes. But that wasn't the case. A lot of jobs that were ended by machines and by automations actually replaced with new jobs for people to work on, maybe in maintenance and, as you said, the quality control and quality assurance after the final product that it's done correctly. So didn't we end the human being in jobs, just started a new jobs. So, and I guess the second point is you always have people asking for more original content, more original handmade content and handmade products. Like now, we have digital painting for a while now, but there is a lot of people that want a hand painting. So I guess if you are really good at your job, you don't have to worry, because you will always have a client that want your the quality you are offering. So I guess that's my point, that's my take on it. You just need to be really good on your on what you are doing, so you don't worry about competitors or about AI or stuff like that. And I see that in many areas that people are thinking that I need to learn to be a web developer, and after a while, no, I need to be a mobile application developer, and after a while, no, I need to be a UI UX, because that's what is, that's the trend now. So they keep shifting from jobs because they are worrying too much that they won't find a client. And what's on the real life is all jobs are continuing, and all jobs are there is people asking for it, and you just need to be really good at it so you can have your audience and your clients keep with you and don't think about other solutions than you.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And one thing I'll also add to that about this idea of chasing trends is I think in general, I don't quite like blanket rules, but I think this is as close to a blanket rule as I'd be happy, asserting, is that it's pretty much always a bad idea to follow trends. And, you know, I can give you a couple of examples. Like first of all, let's say if you really followed the crypto and NFT trend. Now, recently, there was a big collapse, and an industry that was doing really well is now under heavy scrutiny and has a bad kind of public perception. Same thing was true, in the early 2000s with the dot-com bubble. Again, people were chasing trends. There was a big bubble, it popped, and then, just thought it's a nasty environment. Warren Buffett, the most successful investor of all time, has shared, people have asked him, of course, many times, like, what makes him the most successful investor of all time? And he says that it's his temperament. Many investors will be very emotional and chase hype, chase these different trends. And he doesn't. He just thinks, he looks at a company's balance sheet, he looks at a company's accounts, he looks at all kinds of different things, and then makes a very cool-headed decision about, is this a good company, that has solid foundations, that is likely to grow in the future, or not? And, and for example, there's this whole craziness going on with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried at the moment. Again, that was a company, it grew very quickly, had a lot of media attention, did very well, and then suddenly now they're in a huge amount of legal trouble, and a lot of investors' money looks like it's completely disappeared. So I think it's a good lesson in general of just, you shouldn't chase trends. If crypto is something you're passionate about and understand a lot about, then absolutely go for it, build a good project. But don't do it just because that's currently the trend. Or, if building an app is currently the trend, don't do it because of that, Focus on really understanding something, really getting good at something that you believe in, and then focus on that. I really do think that that's the best strategy rather than chasing trends.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. So let me end with you with one last question. Entrepreneurship here in Egypt is actually a huge trend. So the government and a lot of big companies here are pushing towards having young people to create startups and make their idea into small projects and small businesses. But there are sayings that not everyone will be an entrepreneur, and all people are pushing around to be the CEOs and founder of X business, and I want to be an entrepreneur too. I want to be a millionaire. I don't want to work 9-to-5. So all people are pushing toward that path. So what is your advice? When do you think that someone will, we call it self-evaluate for yourself, and say that I can create a business and I have the needed skills to be a CEO or be a founder of a business and create that business and to make it work? And when do you think that I re-evaluate myself to say that I can do that? It's not my area, and I don't want to pursue a false dream in that area?
Sure. So, I think first of all, if you are if the idea of starting a business, you know, and becoming an entrepreneur is attractive to you, then you should definitely try. It doesn't matter if, you know, if you're going to succeed or fail, but you should definitely try it, because I think otherwise maybe later in life, you know, you'll regret not having tried. And especially if you're young, you know, maybe don't have a family of your own yet, you know, you don't have as many responsibilities, you know, to other people, it's a very good time to give it a shot, because you can take bigger risks and basically just see what happens. But in terms of figuring out whether it's the right fit for you, I would say if your primary motivation is making money, then it's probably not the right fit for you, funnily enough. Same thing is true with kind of being a CEO and managing people. If you are really attracted to the idea of managing people, again, it's probably not necessarily the right fit for you. It depends for what reason, again, but, you know, if you, you know, the best managers, in my opinion, are those who will kind of stay out of the limelight. You know, they are responsible for their team. They make sure that, you know, they remove obstacles out of the way of their team's way. But ultimately, they are an enabler of the team rather than like the team enabling them, if that makes sense. So I think the best place to start is to just be very, very, very honest with yourself about what is it that you are looking to achieve in life. Let's say that goal is making a lot of money. Great, you know, but I don't think starting a business is necessarily the best way to achieve that. You'll probably have a higher success rate if you go into some kind of job in finance. You know, there's a higher chance that you will consistently make more money than if you start a business where, you know, it could really fluctuate what you make if you make anything at all, you know, if the business fails, but there's a high chance, just statistically speaking, of that happening. So I think also it's important to realize that, running a business and starting a business is not all like a nice experience. A lot of it can be a very dark and unpleasant experience, and a very lonely experience. So I think when I think what you kind of need to know that, you know, starting a business is right for you is if there is a particular problem that you are very passionate about solving, and that your passion for solving that problem exceeds your kind of passion for making money or for managing other people or for doing any number of those things. Because, you know, then that way, if you start a business and you're not making a lot of money immediately, you know, it doesn't matter, or it matters less, because you are following your passion. And same thing, you know, I think that's kind of the best way to approach the subject. But I'd say, you know, no matter what, if you find the idea appealing or attractive, you know, go and find out for yourself if it's for you. Give it a shot. I don't think there's any harm in trying, because that way you'll know for sure, and you won't ever have any regrets about not having tried. So I don't think you should necessarily talk yourself out of trying. But I think also, you know, you need to understand the fact that running a business, oftentimes it's a case of you work for very long hours, doing very stressful things, not achieving what you want, working for a very, very low wage, if you're even making any money at all, and doing that for a very long period of time. So you really need to have a very strong kind of why, you know, a very strong belief, a very strong mission that you can kind of stick to, you know, to get through that. Because, you know, I think in most cases, people wouldn't want to sit through that. They'd rather do something else. So, I think to sum up, if the idea is attractive to you, definitely try it. But start by being very honest with yourself about what it is you want to achieve. And if your motivation is, more kind of around making money, then you might have a much better success chance going into a job in finance, for example, than you would starting your own business. Just all things to think about. But if you do try, then don't be afraid of failure. Give it your best shot. And no matter what happens, you'll have learned a lot on the other side.
Totally agree with you. I worked for some time in a big institution, which was actually an initiative from the government to help people pursue their ideas and start startups and like suggest them to an accelerators and stuff like that. And I found a lot of people, a lot of students in university were really hyped for the initiative and were really excited to the idea of starting their own businesses, because all of them was really hyped and saying that I have an idea that no one's thinking about before, and I will create an app to do that, and I will create a platform to do this, and I will use IoT, I will use AI, I will use stuff like that in many fields. And it was really great seeing that. But there was a problem that a lot of people think that this idea is, I was the first to think of. I was like, this is a whole new brand idea and I will start right away. And actually, when we heard it, found that there was like three more or maybe four, maybe more, the same idea that you are, is that that person is pitching is actually a duplicate idea, and it's fine. And I want to hear your take on that. Do you think that if someone passionate about an idea that that he have, and he found that that idea is actually made before or created before, and someone else is made a business out of it, how can I make myself special and prioritize my idea and my business of all the similar ideas that out there?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that it's much more about the execution than the idea. I'd say it's 1% idea, 99% execution. And also that oftentimes building on an existing idea is actually a very smart move, because there's such a thing as, you know, like a last mover's advantage in a market, that I think you can relate to us, right? There are already many freelancing platforms that connect clients and freelancers, you know, and on the surface level, we connect clients and freelancers. So you can say, well, wow, that's been done before, right? But we do a couple things to make it better. But, you know, I wouldn't be in a position to know that, you know, to even know about trying those things if I couldn't already see from other platforms what they have tried, what I think works well for them, what I think doesn't work so well for them. So oftentimes, finding a pre-existing thing and then tweaking it so it's better and refining it, that can often be the best way to go. So I would say, you know, I don't think it's that possible to think of a completely unique idea. I mean, of course it's possible, but to think of a completely unique idea that, you know, is going to work is a very difficult thing to do, and also a bit of a foolish thing to do, because, you know, then you don't have that data, you know, you don't have that kind of understanding of how the market works if you're trying to, basically create a completely new market. So, oftentimes it's best to take an already established idea. Obviously, don't copy it, you know, like iterate on it, make it your own, but going into it from that perspective. But ultimately, you know, remember that it's not really about the idea, because your idea is going to change. It's about the execution. So start with something that you think will work. Go out there, you know, try it, speak to customers. You will probably find out that it's a terrible idea and nobody wants to use it, but that's fine, because you've collected some valuable feedback, and then you can make changes, you know, and then you can repeat the process, and you can collect more feedback and make changes again. And then as you continue that cycle, eventually you're going to build a business or a product or a service that is absolutely indispensable to your target audience. And then you've created a successful business. But there's no way before you start that you would be able to come up with that perfect idea right from the beginning, unless it's luck, which again, like I've said before, is not such a good thing, because then you don't actually understand the process. You can't actually explain why what you did worked, you know, and you haven't actually learned from the whole experience. So I'd say, yeah, again, don't be afraid to fail. Start with something, collect feedback, try again, try over and over again, and eventually you'll arrive at something that works really well. But don't try and think of the perfect idea up front, you know. Identify a problem, identify a need in the market, and start there. try and build a solution, speak to people, and just iterate, and then eventually you will come, you will, you know, create the right product or the right business.
I definitely agree with you. Thank you very much for your time, and I really enjoyed that episode. And as I said, it's really, really special episode for me because it's my first English episode. So I hope my English isn't really good, but I hope it went something. Thank you for tolerating with me and being so nice for it. Thank you, Carl.
Well, I mean, I think your English is fantastic, and it's certainly a lot better than my Egyptian. So I really appreciate you being so accommodating. And yeah, I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for having me as a guest. And I hope you have a lovely rest of your week.
You too. Thank you very much. We had Carl, which I really enjoyed the conversation with. CEO of Freelancer, and for what it takes, I would really love to recommend Freelancer podcast. It's really nice podcast. I heard some of their episodes. Carl actually have another episode there, so you can go and hear it, and you can go and hear. So I'm really happy to have you here, and thank you. Have a lovely evening.